Good evening, everyone. Tonight, we begin into the precepts with the first precept, which I will read. Self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. In the realm of everlasting Dharma, not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing. The Buddha's seed grows in accordance with not taking life. Transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom and do not kill. Recognizing that I am not separate from all that is, I vow to take up the way of not killing. This is on page 48, the long precepts. Jeannie, do you see it there?
I'm looking at it right here, yeah.
48?
Yeah.
So you're welcome to look at it if you want to follow along. At first glance, it seems pretty straightforward. Just don't kill. There are, actually for all of these precepts, three ways to look at them. Three sort of tiers, if you will. And the first one is that the precept means what it says. And there's no waffling about it. There's no interpreting it. It just means do not kill. That is always the choice to be made. You can see where you might run into trouble with that one right off the bat. We'll get to that in a bit. The second way is where you need to do some interpretation. You need to make some decisions one way or another. That has its issues too. And the third point of view is the non-dual one. That is from the side of emptiness, of distinctions, where there's not birth and there's not death. Nothing is born, and so nothing can be killed. And this too has its issues. So what is it that we are not to kill? People seems like a pretty obvious answer. We don't want to kill one another. But what about plants, like weeds? How about mollusks, things that live in the sea? What about things that we eat, our food? How about in self-defense? What about wars, the soldiers in wars, wars of self-defense? What about capital punishment or euthanasia? How about taking antibiotics, wiping out those troublesome bacteria? So in the literal point of view, none of those are okay. There's no rationalizing it away. And the most literal religious group that I have come into contact with are the Jains. I used to work with an Indian woman who was a Jain. It's J-A-I-N. And they take this very seriously of not harming other creatures. And so not only did she not eat meat or eggs or fish, but also not root vegetables, because pulling them up out of the ground disturbed the soil microorganisms, and there might be some still clinging to the roots. So they just didn't go there. And the curious thing about this, I mean, so that sounds like, okay, they've taken the hard line, they're doing this thing, you know, as best it was understood, at least when these guidelines were created. We worked in a biology lab, and it was microbiology, and part of what she was required to do when she was finished with the cultures was to autoclave them, to sterilize the cultures, which meant like killing billions of bacteria, right? And so I asked her one day, you know, how does this sync with your beliefs? And she said that, well, they make concessions for people's work. So even here, there's not a hard line to be drawn. Even the least interpretive group that I know of nevertheless had to interpret. So I think that, at least in the Zen point of view, it cannot just be hard and fast, do not kill. Our lives aren't lived in that way. There is vegetarianism, and I was surprised when I first started practicing with Boundless Way that some of our teachers are not vegetarians. I never actually spoke with them about that. I just saw that this was the way of Boundless Way and that we could make our own choices. I pass that on to you for what it's worth. So then there's the making choices as to what is okay killing and what isn't. So there's a story, or perhaps a myth, anyway. It's an old tale. And I've heard it recounted as being about the Buddha, but I've also heard it recounted as being about just the captain of a ship, the Buddha on a ship or a captain on a ship. But the one that I found on the internet and copied over is about the captain. So it says, the Upaya Kausalya Sutra contains the fable of a bodhisattva sea captain whose ship is carrying 500 merchants who are on the path to becoming bodhisattvas. But there's also a robber aboard, and the robber intends to rob and kill the bodhisattva-to-be merchants. The captain rules out warning the merchants because they might be tempted to throw the robber overboard, and the resulting bad karma would delay their becoming bodhisattvas. He's really thought this through. And this would be very bad because more than anything else, the world needs bodhisattvas. We don't want to delay it. So instead, the captain killed the robber himself, accepting the consequent rebirth in hell for 100,000 eons, but helping all beings in the process. So here is an extreme example of making a choice about whether it's better to cause greater harm and suffering throughout the world for all beings because these bodhisattvas are held back from their path, or to take it upon one being to suffer, well, two, the one who died and the one who took the responsibility for that, in order to save a lot of other suffering. So these are the kinds of, this is obviously kind of a, not something we're likely to encounter in our day-to-day lives specifically, but this sort of having to choose the lesser of the evils, right? That's more likely what we would come up against. And you can see where interpreting this as, you know, when it's okay to kill and when it's not, can very quickly slide you down to a disturbing place where an ideology is upheld at the expense of others who must die in order to maintain it. The greater good is that this sparkling way of being or living be available to a community, but these people have to go because they would stand in the way of it. So we get the Chairman Mao's and the Pol Pot's and this sort of situation. So nothing is clear here in what had seemed to be such a simple and straightforward precept that we really have to bring to it our own discrimination and our own wondering about it all the time. And this is true for all of the precepts, that there is always this aspiration that's being set forth, and generally impossible to really live purely in that way. And then there's our failed intentions, right? Our falling short. So this constant tension that we hold between our aspirations and the reality of the situation. And not our job to resolve that. Our job to maintain in the center of it, or maybe oscillating back and forth, sort of like breathing in and out. To be able to sit right in the middle of that uncertainty, of that failure, you might say, and to be able to function from that place. So this is the challenge that's set before us by all of these precepts. So part of recognition of this failure for any of the precepts is the possibility to atone. The very first chant that we do every evening that we meet is this gatha of atonement, so necessary, and to be seen as a support for us in our inability to be perfect, pure beings, a way for us to bring that to the front and to live into it. And then the third way of looking at things, this non-dual way. So in each of these long versions of the precepts, they always begin with self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. That's actually a change from how it used to read. It used to be self-nature is subtle and mysterious. And in fact, I have inside information that we are going to soon have a new edition of the chant book, and they're going to switch it back. So self-nature seems to be a changing thing like everything else in the universe. It's going to change back to subtle and mysterious. But for the time being, inconceivably wondrous. And then the next, the center portion of this longer precept is a conflation of Bodhidharma's statements about the precept and Dogen's statement about the precept. So Bodhidharma says, in the realm of everlasting Dharma, not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing. So Bodhidharma tends to take this non-dual approach to the precepts. So right off the bat, he says, in the realm of everlasting Dharma. So he's telling us where he comes from. And then not giving rise to the idea of killing. How in the world can we accomplish that? How can we control what we give rise to in our minds? I thought for a bit about this, it occurs to me that, so what he's pointing to is that if one already has a clear view, an understanding that the universe is not separate from us, that everything is one great body, then there cannot arise the idea of killing. It would be like if we said, well, my right hand does a lot, you know, I'm right-handed, my right hand is like constantly doing stuff for me, but that left hand, it's worthless. So when I eat, I'm only going to feed the right hand, no food for the left hand. And you can't do it. When you eat, it feeds the whole body, right? So we know that. We know that this is a whole body. And it doesn't even occur to us to think that we might starve one hand in order to reward the other. It's not something that arises. And in the same way, with a clear view of how we are interconnected with the universe, how we are fully part of it, and a full expression of it, as is everything, there can be no arising of the thought of killing. Even if an action occurs that looks like killing, It may not be resulting from an idea of killing. And then Dogen takes up the cause, and he says, "The Buddha's seed grows in accordance with not taking life. Transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom and do not kill." Dogen is a bit more practical. He points out how this is an ongoing thing. The Buddha's seed grows in accord with not taking life. So he gives us a path to follow, an aspiration. And then says, transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom. Do not kill. And then it finishes up with recognizing that I am not separate from all that is. So going back to the non-dual, the oneness point of view. Recognizing that I am not separate from all that is. I vow to take up the way of not killing. A very compassionate view. It says, if we do harm, we are both the one harmed and the one doing the harm. If others do harm, we are that other as well as the one who is being harmed. So taking responsibility for not just our own actions, but for all that goes on. Feeling this is our own. It's really kind of a remarkable precept. So challenging. Always there in front of us. Every time we eat, the opportunity to be grateful for these lives that are given so that ours can be sustained. We do a lot of bowing and chanting before each meal during retreats. To honor that fact, this preciousness of life, and how it's impossible for us to continue to live unless other beings do not. Subtle and mysterious, inconceivably wondrous. Not